Rich Egger, and this is Emphasis. Today's guest is Steve Barry. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Georgia. Barry has written extensively about the American Civil War, and he was in Western Illinois this week to speak at Monmouth and Knox Colleges and Western Illinois University. Did you grow up in the South?
I grew up in Florida, in Central Florida. Florida, of course, seceded third, so you'd think it was Southern, but Central Florida isn't Southern at all. Florida is one of those funny states where the further north you go, the further south you are.
Mm-hmm.
So, no. And it wasn't until I did my graduate work at the University of North Carolina that I really started asking questions about what is this thing, the South?
And what did you find when you asked those questions?
Well, the memory of the Civil War there was very strong. And there's, you know, nothing in Florida, no statues. So I think that's when and why I became a Civil War historian. I'd seen Ken Burns' series in 1990. So I was interested in it already, but the memory of it was so strong in North Carolina that it tugged at me, and I said, I want to figure out what this is.
And what have you figured out so far?
Because I teach a Civil War course, I've learned the battles, but I'm not one of those people who particularly care who watered Lee's horse on the third day at Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
There are those people out there, and I admire their knowledge. For me, the Civil War is this immense pool of sadness that I find hypnotic. I mean, you had hundreds of thousands of men in the South who have fought on the wrong side of a great moral question, and that's tough to get over, and I understand why it's taken a while to get over.
You mentioned the moral question. You know, sometimes we hear World War II referred to as being the good war with,
right,
you know, good triumphing over evil. Could that same label be applied to the Civil War, or is that tougher because you have Americans fighting against Americans?
Right. And so the real way to consider the war is not that we fought this great war and purged slavery from our midst, but that we fought our bloodiest war because we couldn't find a solution short of war to give up our original addiction to black gold, to slavery. There was too much money to be made. It was too huge an interest. And so, as we now understand, 700,000 men died because we couldn't find a peaceful solution.
Are some of those thoughts and feelings included in this book that you edited, Weirding the War, Stories from the Civil War's Ragged Edges?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a tendency sometimes to glorify the Civil War to a degree, to create stories of plumed cavaliers and charges. I think that's a mistake, and so I wanted a grittier version of the war the way it really was, where selfish people did selfish things and did an immense amount of damage. That's what the book is really about. War is always about damage, and it always has collateral damage, and we need to figure that into our understanding of what the war was as well.
Well, what can you tell us about that collection, Weirding the War? Did you contribute anything to that, or beyond the editing, did you write any of the stories?
I did. I wrote up my research into coroner's reports in South Carolina. I did 1840 to 1880 for selected counties in South Carolina. And what I found is, for instance, if you're a white male and the coroner is standing above your body, you most likely died of a combination of alcohol and stupidity. You fell off your horse and broke your neck or drowned in a little river. If you are a white female, you hung yourself. If you are African-American male, you hung yourself. So our portrait of the South is often of this very violent place of honor, duels, and things like that. It's a self-destructive place. It's white men drinking themselves and their dependents to death. How this fits into a Civil War volume, well, you take those same guys and you send them away. And our story is usually, and it usually was, well, the family is going to miss you. I'm going to miss you so much, Daddy. We're going to write all of these letters. And that's all true. But what you also have is the men leave and suddenly no more spousal abuse, no more spousal rape, no more child abuse, no more unwanted pregnancies. So in some households, when Daddy left, they were relieved.
Do you feel the Civil War is now less romanticized than it once was?
I think so. The wars that we've been involved in, Iraq and Afghanistan, have sobered us up again to what war really is. And so it has shaped the way we understand and the lens through which we see our own civil war. It becomes much harder to romanticize war when your country's involved in it, when you know people who are over there and they know what it really is.
Yet there's remains, I believe, a great fascination with the Civil War. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I mean, I'll say Shelby Foote is exactly right about one thing. It was the crossroads of our being. I think, you know, everything that's important about our history comes to this watershed moment in the Civil War. It made us who we are. It's immensely important. It sweeps millions of men into service. It kills 750,000 men. It frees 3 million people. And when you remember that the population then is so much smaller, if we lost in proportion the number of men that they lost, it would be 7 million people. We'd feel that.
Do you think part of the interest, too, is that you can actually go to the sites where some of these battles were fought, very easily go to some of these sites?
Right. It happened here. And I think when you tell students about things, they try to picture it. But when you take them there and you say, you're sharing a bit of ground where this ghost once stood, they feel it a whole lot more. So, yes, absolutely. The fact that this massive bloodletting occurred on American soil is a very big deal.
And, of course, the major figure of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, you've written about him. The book House of Abraham, Lincoln and the Todds, A Family Divided by War. Can you tell us a bit about the book?
Sure. The book is really about Lincoln's relationship with his in-laws. And like most in-laws, they were a thorn in the side occasionally. The thing we have to remember about Lincoln is that he didn't really have a family of his own. So his mother died early. His brother died early. His sister died early. He never got along with his father. So what he knew about family, the way it fights and falls apart and then comes together when times are tough, all of that he learned from the Todds. Well, then it's very difficult to watch this family, 14 kids, on the rack during the Civil War, like many Kentucky families that are broken almost exactly in half. So it's strange to me that people don't know that Mary Todd Lincoln had two brothers who fought and died for the Confederacy. And you can imagine what it would mean if Michelle Obama had brothers in Al-Qaeda. Surely they would play politics with that. Well, somehow we've forgotten that they played politics with Mary's relations to the Confederacy as well. So when Lincoln looks out and sees the Civil War as this familied conflict, it's not just metaphorical. It's his personal experience.
Did this family, the Todds, did they really test his patience too?
Oh, absolutely. They scandalized his administration in a million ways. But I also look at some of the tender affections that he had even for Confederate members of the family. There was a rebel brigadier general, Benjamin Hardin Helm, who'd married into the Todd family and was killed at Chickamauga. When Lincoln learned that this brigadier general on the other side had been killed, he said, "I feel as David of old when told of the death of Absalom." If you go to the second book of Solomon and read it, it says, "Would to God I had died for thee, Absalom, my son, my son." So Lincoln is really broken up that this friend of his who was chosen to be on the opposite side has passed away. Benjamin Hardin Helm's widow then needs to get back from Atlanta to Union-occupied Kentucky. She writes she gets a pass from Lincoln, but then they at Virginia, they ask her to take the oath of allegiance. She refuses. They don't know quite what to do. Here they have a note from their commander-in-chief that says this woman's supposed to go through, but they also have a law that she has to take the oath of allegiance. They write to Lincoln, and he says, "Send her to me." So in December 1863, you have the widow of a slain Confederate general staying for a week in the White House. Lincoln's telling you something by his actions. He is sticking his neck way out politically to have such a person in his house. So there were real affections within the family, even though they were divided by the war.
It sounds like perhaps he's already thinking, too, that at some point this nation is going to need to come back together.
That's absolutely right. And one of the interesting things is that the Todd family does come together. Emily Todd, the one who stayed in the White House, her daughter writes the first biography of Mary Todd Lincoln, and it's a very affectionate biography. So as much as the Todds were occasionally dysfunctional, often alcoholic, and had a high tolerance for other people's pain, after the Civil War, they are some of the earliest people to come together and to try to build national reconciliation on this metaphor that we are one family. Unfortunately, in their version of this story, it's one white family.
How'd you come up with the idea of focusing on Lincoln's family life?
Well, kind of strangely, I did my graduate work at the University of North Carolina, and in the Southern Historical Collection, they have the papers of Nathaniel Henry Rhodes Dawson. He's a Confederate captain, and I was looking for love letters, which is what I used for my first book. Well, he's writing to Elodie Todd, Mary's sister, and they eventually get married. But in one of her letters, her family on the rack, she's divided from her northern sisters. She says, "Surely there is no other family placed in the exact situation as ours, and I hope there will never be a family surrounded by trials so numerous." And this got me. I mean, I'm an historian, so when somebody says no other family, I'm like, oh, come on. Let me find out. Is it true? And I thought about it, and she's right. There is no other family that is stretched between the Confederate trenches and the federal White House. That is a family on a unique rack. And I said, somebody needs to write this book.
What are you working on now?
I am working on Edgar Allan Poe. It's mostly, I think of it as what it meant to drink yourself to death in the grand age of temperance.
And what about that story drew you?
To be honest, it isn't as far a leap as it might seem. Both Lincoln and Poe were born in 1809. Both were born in the South and then moved to the North. Both were depressives. They obviously did very different things with their depression. Lincoln grappled with his demons and then learned to feel other people's pain. Poe was bettered by his demons and mostly wanted to inflict pain, either literally or in his literature.
And is there anything surprising you've learned while researching Poe?
I think that his contemporaries knew and watched him drink himself to death and punished him for it. And now, ironically, he's immortal in part because of that. He's Jim Morrison. We want our great rock stars to sort of flame out early and leave a good-looking corpse. But in the 1840s, that was not done. So that, I think, has been one of the most interesting things, just to see that alcohol, his relationship with alcohol is at the heart of his literature and in the heart of his relationships with his peers.
And then has his legend grown over the years, I guess? How was he regarded at the time of his death?
As a pathetic, self-damned soul. It was really only when the French picked him up after the turn of the century and he seemed like a bad man, but then also sort of a necromancer and a gateway to forbidden knowledge, that he was redeemed, in part because he had looked at life and said, no, I'm going to drink myself to death instead. And that act of perversion, as it was seen in the 1840s, by the early 1900s, was seen as something almost heroic, as a statement about the vacuity of life. And I guess I would say now he's probably even more popular. I think there are very few poets, in fact, one, who's given his name to a football team. The Baltimore Ravens, of course,
That's
are named
right.
after Poe's most famous poem. So he's extraordinarily well compensated. The man is immortal.
That is Steve Barry, who is an associate professor of history at the University of Georgia. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Egger.